Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Robin Davies. You're listening to the second part of a two-part interview that I conducted last year with Dr. Inge Kall on the topic of global public goods.
This was on the SDG framework itself, and you've already referred to it as a muddle. But I'd be interested to get a slightly fuller sort of appraisal from your perspective of the framework that we're likely to get. It's very clear that it won't be changed much when it's endorsed.
No.
York, and the only real question is whether it is framed in certain ways, and the Secretary General has made one suggestion in that regard. So assuming that that's roughly the framework, I was interested in your perspective on how useful it is, whether it's any advance on the MDGs, so on.
We will get it. No, where? And there's nothing new. Nothing new in it. Most of the goals that are there, we have them already.
Yeah.
In addition, most of them are already in national level policy documents. So there is nothing. It can serve us as a reminder also. If it then comes to the implementation, what would be important is that the developing countries formulate their own country programs, those who still hope to get aid, that they have strong country programs, that developing countries formulate their own GPG agenda. In which areas do they hope that we will move on which GPG, in which way, in order to achieve what? And then we would have to think through a reform that comes to your questions that are further down. Because we need nationally and internationally, one layer, organizational layer, is missing, and that is the issue focus. We are now nationally and internationally organized according to geographic lines and economic sector lines.
Yeah.
But we don't want to strengthen just the health sector. We want to control diseases. We don't just want to do agriculture. We want to achieve food security. We just don't want to have clean air in cities. We want climate stability. So we need this issue management. And when we take the climate change area, we have UNFCCC in Bonn, but they are an issue manager for the negotiation side, and it's a very complex side. So UNFCCC has the hands full with the negotiations, but we have no operational manager. Some CEO for climate change mitigation, and then that CEO would need sub CEOs for various types of mitigation, whether it's via energy, clean energy, or whatnot. And one would need someone dealing with adaptation. In the health area, we are coming, the beginnings are all there. We have this Ebola son. So the beginnings are there, but out of compulsion and not foresight. That's the sad part. The reality is forcing it on us, this issue management.
So with food security as well.
And the Secretary General Kofi started, and Ban Ki-moon has continued it with his special issue envoys. It all points to the fact that we need to pull multi-sector, multi-level, multi-actor threats together in order to get to the good. And when I make presentations, I often say, imagine the CEO of a Boeing company. And he would sit there in his office and say, wouldn't it be nice if we had a Dreamliner? But we say, wouldn't it be nice to leave nobody behind and rid the world of hunger? But then the CEO he or she knows where to get the wheels and where to get the engines constructed and where the outer shell and this and that and whatnot, whatever goes into a plane, and they assemble the plane.
Yeah.
And they don't 1 year just make the wing and 10 years later a wheel, so they get it done.
So when you talk about these sort of issue-based functions, let's say, but not necessarily organizations, are you thinking only in terms of global public goods or a broader range of issues?
No, no.
Yeah.
The global one is the same. You could do on a regional basis. But a CEO for the major one and then subcomponents underneath. And for some issue areas, like I'm fascinated, there's nobody who actually deals with outer space.
Yeah,
there is a committee also, but imagine what is going on up there.
Mm.
Yeah? Why don't we have a space agency?
Yeah. Mm.
But this issue with UNEP, we have an environmental sort of umbrella, but they have been taken apart into so many components. So they could also sort of be the guardian who looks, or the steward who looks, whether everything that should happen is happening. But then there would be need to be sub-managers underneath. And most global issues are so complex that you really need a clever CEO.
And so this should clearly have been, well, in fact, it's written into the mandates of organizations like WHO, FAO.
Yeah, but they are negotiating organizations. They are not operational.
Well, they've become operational, but much more in a servicing donor sort of way.
But also, in order to, if you had a staff for malaria, that entity should even probably be in a position to hold property rights.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and the WHO cannot, the UN cannot. So, one needs really operational agencies.
Really, the biggest problem is you can set up a structure or even a SAR within the UN system, but that system controls very few resources. The big problem seems to be integrating what happens across the multilateral and regional development banks and the UN system, and also bilateral.
No, but you would think differently. I mean, the World Bank, I don't know what to do with the World Bank. I mean, they should wonder what their future is. Because these lumpy organizations were an interim solution for a time where countries were still lacking a lot of capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm.
And where we had a stronger country focus.
Mm.
So as long as we have country programs, you need something like UNDP or the World Bank. But the World Bank has now all the competition from the regional banks and from the BRICS Bank and from the Asian Bank. So they have to think hard where their comparative advantage lies. And for global public goods, I mean, they could become, you know, like our budget for global public goods, where we but what would they do? You have to give the money to the Global Health Fund for this or that in order to get the incentives right.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a lumpy organization. I mean, maybe for economies of scale, but it requires a lot of thinking.
Yeah.
They could be sort of an umbrella for all the global funds, it may be cumbersome. That was actually a motivation why I started talking about global public goods, because you have to produce a good.
Mm.
And so you better think about how to produce it.
Mm.
It's not strengthening and improving and endless thing. So preferably these goods should be produced, and maybe sometimes you can just stop there, you know.
Yeah.
And But we have to see. We are still in an experimental stage for the time being. I think we need global funds to fight externalities in a very targeted way. Therefore, they should be financed when there are health out of health budgets, when there are environment out of environment budgets, because most of the time they are externality fighters. Or conditionality through the back door. No? But when we are open and we say it's for GPG purposes, I have no problems with conditionality because then I buy a good. An input to a good.
Going back then to the structure of the SDGs, would you have preferred to see like a more binary approach where there are targets for essentially national action and global targets?
The opportunity is not lost. We could now think through, as a matter of urgency, in view of Paris, about the operational side of climate change, mitigation and adaptation. We need a CEO for this.
Yeah.
That's very urgent. Then on the health side, I think we are actually, when it comes to externality management, we are quite better established because we have the Global Fund and we have some R&D initiatives, but nevertheless, we should look through these global issue areas and see where is a CEO missing.
So in terms of organizing action, you don't see the SDGs as a barrier in terms of...
No, it's like a Fata Morgana on the horizon.
Yeah.
And now the challenge is how do I get there?
Yeah.
And we need the global issue managers and the countries. When I started with UNDP, we still had country programming. And countries were in charge. And we actually, my briefing was, you don't interfere. No, the country sets the priorities when I went out. And then everything suddenly, then structural adjustment came, and everything turned around. And the eight management units we had been setting up in various countries were closed, and PRSPs and whatnot came instead. So it was a whole turnaround. And so countries have to take charge again of their own programming.
The idea that countries would set their own, even quite poor countries would set their own GPG agendas is interesting, and it's not often said. So how might they articulate those agendas, particularly thinking from a financing perspective? Would they say, these things are important to us, but we can't do anything about them without external support, or these things are important to us and we will take action up to this point, but if you help us, we will take action up to a further point? What would be the structure?
There was a meeting with Kazachkin, is his name, he was previously in the health fund, in Geneva, where I addressed this point. Basically, all the money that goes to the Global Health Fund should first have gone to the country level, to developing countries.
Yeah.
And then the developing countries should have been sitting together saying, for reasons of economies of scale and scope and whatnot, we finance a global health fund. And for TB, and so the developed countries could have put additional money in straight. But the developing countries should understand that basically the global health fund is theirs.
Yeah.
If everything were okay. And then they would have it in their budget. Yeah, they would know how much does it cost them to fight malaria and HIV/AIDS. But they would save money by pooling and doing it together, doing bulk purchasing and whatnot.
Yeah, so the Global Fund exists partly for reasons of efficiency and partly because...
But we pretend it is basically our fund.
So is that mainly an issue of governance? Even if donors had established the fund as they did, Could they have established the governance very differently to put?
I would have let the money go, make a memorandum of understanding even to begin with, to be sure. But the developing, I will go around and ask the developing country representative whether they consider that to be their fund.
No. Yeah, that's interesting. So the suggestion is not that they would freely choose whether to invest in that fund or not. It's more that they would receive the resources on the understanding that they would create a fund, but the creation of it. The way they do it is that.
Or I could have even, just a paper transaction saying, you know, we send, you basically have so much aid more than you think you have.
Yeah.
But we, because the other way, I can understand the worries, how do we get the money back into the fund? But at least as a, in order to have it all clear in our heads, it would have been good to make such a phony transaction.
Yeah, okay. Which then, I guess, there is a precedent in the formation of the climate investment funds at the World Bank. This is a case where there was a very conscious decision to establish governance arrangements 50-50, so developed and developing country. So it's constituency-based, quite a small group, maybe 12 developed, 12 developing. And for the Swiss, it worked well. That's not to say it's going to work well forever, but then this was carried over into the Green Climate Fund. Do you think that is a reasonable, I guess it's a compromise, but do you think that goes some way toward creating that sort of, that sense of...
No, at least it gives developing countries a stronger voice.
Yeah.
No? One hopes they will use it. But so that I don't have at the next fundraising meeting on the Green Climate Fund, repose my question.
All right. So your basic perspective on the SDGs is in themselves, they're neither here nor there, but it's the operational. It's the operationalization of them that matters.
No, also, I actually, the whole process was strange. Because the UN consulted, but I have made it much to the dismay of many of our politicians here. I'm having a hobby. I'm always asking people, including parliamentarians, you know the SDGs? And if they know, they think it's for the developing countries, but that they are universal. So we should have, we are undermining democracy by having such consultations, which consult people on a community, global community good, basically through individual questionnaires or it is like advertisement from a department store coming to me. You prefer red or blue for the next season? No.
Yeah.
We as a community should have asked ourselves how much is climate worth our money or anything else or equity or so. And then our diplomats can go. But for the UN... to reach down into the countries, I must say, I'm a conservative.
So that the universality aspect of the SDGs, which is sort of widely lauded within the UN system, I don't think it's well understood more generally, but presumably from your perspective, it would be important if it were understood and applied.
It would be important if we were to then properly define our goal, as I say, in respect to multilateral trade.
Yeah.
So, okay, where are our subsidies, perverse ones, that we can cut, or market restrictions, or, or should we continue importing all these flowers from Ethiopia and Kenya, taking the water of these countries out and eating it here and drinking it?
Yeah.
It's crazy. So the things like this, so our contribution to climate and water management and so could be through these discussions that we would say, okay, we now grow our own tomatoes and don't take them from there or the flowers.
So, you know, the fundamental feature of the MDGs was the focus on concrete quantitative targets, and who knows how much it really mattered, but it seems to me that targets don't really play such a significant role in the SDGs in a couple of ways.
No, have you seen my paper on the missing middle?
Yes.
First of all, you know, targets, okay, if you want targets, it's fine when one has a sense of direction. But what was really amazing is to discuss goals, keep mum about the means of implementation, and then have indicators of success. Now, how do I get from the goals to the success if I don't know what is in the middle? I try to argue that we can have the ultimate goals, but the agenda should have really had as its targets that by such and such date we have this and this enhanced flexibility in trips.
Yeah.
By such and such date, we have $100 billion in the Green Climate Fund.
Yeah, so that's my question. Yeah, so it seems that there's nothing in the structure of the SDG targets that will even slightly motivate international cooperation. I don't know if anyone could really argue that the MDG targets did that because they were business as usual targets, but there was an opportunity at least here.
And then I think partly as a result of some of the discussions we had on the missing middle also in New York, it started that because needs of implementation were only the last little para initially in the goals, and then they started fiddling little means of implementation hints. Yeah. One should say, at means of implementation into other goals also. But when I look at what is going to Addis, I'm not very optimistic, I must say. One funny thing at the international level is, which is also different from previous years, we are mobilizing money, but where are the projects?
Mm-hmm.
The private sector would never do that. You have a good project and then you look for the financing.
Yeah.
And we sort of $100 billion for the Green Climate Fund. Yeah. But who prepares the pipeline? And in way back in the 80s, like FAO had a pre-investment center.
Mm-hmm.
And they were helping countries to develop pipeline projects.
Yeah.
Who does it now?
Yeah.
And then one can have a rough idea of costing of what we need for infrastructure and so on, but who develops the projects?
And this kind of characteristic of the aid system, though, isn't it? You start with what you're willing to give, and then you say, bring me the projects that fit within my envelope.
Yeah.
So would you suggest that at least...
Which was okay for the aid people because you had on the other side the government plans and budgets and whatnot.
Mm.
But now with GPGs, you are up into the air.
Yeah, nobody has the plans.
No.
So what would be the alternative? Would it be essentially... I guess to say to potential suppliers of GPGs, what can you do at what price?
No, I mean, if we had these issue managers.
Yeah.
And in part, you see beginnings of this sort of pipeline development in the IPCC report, where they say one could do this and one could do this. And so a real issue manager would now think, so how, where are the potentially best providers?
Yeah.
And then you can still have meetings with the private sector and say, our view, this could be interesting, but go and check it. And either we don't hear anything about investment plans because our sneaky suspicion is that we just give it to the private sector. Could be because also the Green Climate Fund has a private sector window, so the clients are probably already standing in the wings. No?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, why would you put a lot of money up? What?
Mm.
But, one can know. I mean, also for WHO, they could... there's something I saw along those lines. What are the R&D efforts we have to undertake? Do we need new vaccine for malaria, new something for TB?
Yeah.
Because they have to be renewed every few years, or for any other disease. So they could make a rough calculation of the amount that goes into R&D.
Which is like $3 billion at the moment. It's about $3 billion annually at the moment.
Lots of money.
So in the case of global public goods, would it make more sense, particularly in articulating SDG targets? I mean, it's the horse's bolted, but would it have been better to begin with at least a broad estimate of needs to set those as targets, even if only aspirational, in order to create some pressure to move toward them? This is very different from what's done with aid, which has an input target. But do you think that's a more appropriate approach in the case with TPGs? Take the $100 billion, for example, for climate. Slightly question.
There's a study where it doesn't come totally out of the air.
No.
I mean, there are these overall, for infrastructure, $1 trillion or so for developing countries. So one can have this so that we know what effort lies ahead, but then immediately one should rush and prepare projects. And I don't know. Maybe the private sector has them. But then we should have a good meeting with the private sector on all of this.
Do you think it matters whether GPG financing is considered as part of ODA, or is it really, is the problem simply that it tends to be subtracted from existing levels of ODA? If governments were to simply expand their ODA budgets, is there anything inherently wrong with thinking of GPG financing?
Yeah, it's not development. It doesn't belong there.
But it is partly development, isn't it? I mean, most of the things that ODA is spent on in the GPG category are probably much more important to developing countries than ourselves. They are important to us, but probably more so to developing countries.
No, because then we also forget about the... that we are purchasing. It's not ODA is a transfer. But when you do something about climate change mitigation in a developing country, you buy a very precious service. And the thank you should be on your side and not on the developing country side. And it's not assistance, it's buying a service.
But is it always just black and white? Because in some cases, obviously the service benefits both parties, so we're buying it for them as much as ourselves. And in many cases, we're buying it from countries that do have significant capacity of their own, so there's that pricing question. And given how difficult it is to justify any particular decision about pricing, is it worth bothering? If the weight of benefits is in favour of that country,
it's a hegemonic thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's either moral, ethical, and then one has to be worried. Often, moral and ethical comes together with a sort of condescending attitude. So therefore, when it's genuine, it's fine. But the sooner you can get out of food, the better. So I would like to restrict the term ODA for where it is really assistance is needed and given.
Yeah.
Everything else is a deal. And for equality and participation and meeting as equals, no, we must get rid of this. There's such a colonial past linked to it.
I mean, I can see how the distinction is easy to make. If you're buying services from a middle-income country who you probably aren't really getting much odour to, and if you're providing business odour to a very poor country who you probably aren't getting environmental services from,
business. Limited, yeah.
But what if it's a really poor country? Let's say it's an African country with significant deforestation, but also massive development.
Why don't you pay for the diamonds out of order? It's coming from a very poor country. They use order for it, and 0.7 will be reached soon. We can do it in many other areas. We differentiate. It wouldn't occur to us to say we pay iron ore or oil or something out of order. Why environmental services?
I guess this is the other aspect of the question. I mean, that's kind of definitional, and it probably doesn't matter exactly.
But I think it's not accidental that the Indians and also the Chinese don't use development assistance that term. They have solidarity, which is already better than assistance. You know, assistance is always to someone who is limping. And they have solidarity programs, and that should tell us that there is you look at the other party as weak and other able, to put it mildly. And therefore one should, where it's still justified with faith and failing states and whatnot, one should have good attitude, but otherwise just get rid of it.
Well, and that sort of brings me to the burden sharing question. It's part of the worry there in my mind is just how you apportion the benefits and therefore the costs in some of these kinds of actions. And as you said earlier, you know, often it would just be a pragmatic decision. But let's say we're talking about capitalizing a global fund like the Green Climate Fund. In your view, ideally, what sort of burden sharing arrangements should apply in those cases? How should a country like China or India or Brazil participate in those sort of funds? Should they be financiers or should they be service providers with financing from the fund or both?
A Green Climate Fund, if they want to participate, they can, of course, and I think they are thinking even about contributing.
They'll make very smart.
But we have undertaken to set the climate straight and make a contribution to that. So in order to be credible, one simply has to live up to it. And to the extent that China is advancing to being best polluter, I think they will, they are politically savvy, they will start contributing.
But, if you remember back, it was pre-Copenhagen, I think in 2009, Mexico developed a model of a green climate fund in which all countries contributed, or almost all countries except the poorest, contributed financially, but developing countries, even if they had contributed, were then able to get resources back out of the fund. There was no kind of trade-off there. And that was very much to recognise the global public good nature of what the fund was there to do. Do you think there's value in that model, or do you see it much more as a financing mechanism of the developed countries?
It has been turned into this because I was quite disappointed when I read one governing board document after the other from the Green Climate Fund, where they first talked about giving the money to the best suited provider. And now it says,
country allocation. It's always the same.
Then you turn it again, you know, it's crumbs here, crumbs there. It's not really an investment attitude. It's a distributional attitude. And you slip back into old modes.
So that's to do with the allocation of the funds. I mean, yeah, that's a big issue.
No, and so. I think to the extent, I think China is in large measure also arguing for the rest of the developing countries. You know? So, but I could imagine that the more they recognize their own future pollution role, they will make an effort. And they know that it will bring them political credit and
So from a pragmatic perspective, does it make sense for a financing mechanism like the GCF basically to be capitalized by developed countries, and on the developing country side they either take domestic action like China or they sell services into the fund?
They sell services, execute projects, you mean? I mean, we want to do climate change mitigation, and whoever can reduce most, fastest, should do it. But that I don't not see in the fund.
There's
a risk that they will also try to give something to Belize or...
It's already happened, I think, in the case of the climate investment funds. That happened.
And so one has to aim at rebuilding trust, and you rebuild trust by sticking to your agreements, like we tell the Greek.
We have already talked about allocation to countries, and your view is strongly that the money should flow to where the goods can be provided, you know, most cost effectively. It's a cost benefit calculation.
Yeah, I mean, for adaptation, it should go where adaptation is needed. And our country allocation is needed, because it has to be done in the country. But you also wouldn't give adaptation money to a country which has no adaptation problems. But when it comes to climate change mitigation, the country that can make a big bang for the buck should get the money. And therefore, I mean, actually, there's nothing wrong with the current pattern of climate finance when you see that 90% are really going to the major polluting developing countries. But if it's ODA money involved, and so then, of course, the question mark. But from just the financing pattern as such, not considering the source it's coming from, the pattern, I would say, is quite okay, because it goes mainly to India and China.
Whether it's going to the right sectors within that's a different
question. Yeah, that's a different question. You can't see already from a...
So then there are, I guess, two other allocation or distribution questions. We've talked about the country distribution question, but distribution between global public goods themselves, how do you make choices about, you know, because you could say that, and this is the kind of thing that the Copenhagen Consensus Center, Bjorn Lomborg, says, you know, aid money, he's talking about aid, and he'll say aid money is so much better spent on, you know, maternal and child health or vaccination than on climate change mitigation, because you get X dollars back for every dollar you spend. And you might get a lower return on your climate change mitigation investment. Well, there are many problems with that argument, but it does have some force. And if you're making choices between different global public goods, the same style of argument might be applied. You're better off spending money on climate change mitigation than on infectious disease control, for example. What do you say about how to deal with those sort of allocation decisions?
I mean, you can a good cost-benefit analysis, however rough, but making some sense, would tell us that I'm pretty sure that the money is best spent on climate, because otherwise we are sitting here healthy but going down the drain due to the weather. You know, I mean, we have to. But it may be the wrong question, because I think if you have good investment projects, and one should look at it as not an expenditure of a fixed amount, but investment. And if you have good investment proposals where you have a good rate of return, we know we can find the money. The money, finding the money where there is a good cause is not the problem. We find a lot of money even for bad causes. So if we can really show that, taking the energy, clean energy route to climate change mitigation, and you save costs on your expenditure in your own house and for the cities and the countries altogether, and we stabilize the climate, so that would be an attractive thing to do. And then if we save, get so many bucks back, if we control certain diseases, we can find that money also. So in a way, I have a problem with this saying we have so much money, like Björn Lomborg, and now where do we put it? No, let's be investors, and be entrepreneurs, look where the good, and then we just invest. And therefore, that I'm missing, that that people are standing there saying, Bill Gates and so we, but he comes from the private sector side.
And maybe the other part of this, and I think what seems to me a problem with Lomborg's arguments is that some of the risks that he's talking about are truly unquantifiable. You can't make a judgment about whether the risks associated with failing to control infectious diseases are greater than the risks associated with failing to control climate change. You know, in both cases, the economic impacts could be absolutely massive.
Until you have looked through all the assumptions of precautionary principle and then a good, relatively good investment project, then off we go. But that needs also change in our outlook,
And then the other question is, the other allocation question, which is more mundane, is about allocating to agents, I guess, which for the most part will be, well, there's a question about the bilateral, multilateral split. How far should bilateral actors really be trying to deliver or support the production of global public goods through developing country action? And even on the multilateral.
Well, that touches on a very interesting question, because I think what is happening is that we are trying to avoid multilateralism, even in climate area, because basically we are looking for export opportunities and market shares. And I'm sometimes wondering whether we are not getting seeing progress on the multilateral climate fund, because we really don't want it.
Although there was a time, I mean, Australia was doing bilateral work on RED because I think we wanted market share, in a sense, for RED credits from Indonesia and Papua New Guinea.
So if they, and that, that I see in some countries, that we keep this risk of climate change there in front of our eyes in order to develop new markets. And that, there's nothing wrong with it. It's probably necessary, and otherwise we couldn't do it, because we need all green private products, from green cars, green building materials, green clothes, green everything. And by consuming this green stuff, we are generating positive externalities, or at least not sending out negative ones. And the industry also needs some time still before. So somehow, I can't really prove it, but somehow I sense that there is a link between going slow on a multilateral agreement and hoping that it can ultimately, because governments confront all these fiscal constraints, that they hope it can be resolved through the market, through green products. And not on their watch, as long as they are in government. There's another factor. Who are the longer-term thinkers? I think they are more on the company side than on the government side. For companies.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about moves within the OECD to introduce a notion of total official support for sustainable development. I mean, you're well aware of what is driving this, and it's not all good. I mean, there are mixed motivations, obviously. Some donors do actually want to clean up the concept of odour, push some stuff out, and then you talked about asylum seeker-related costs.
But they're pushed in.
But more the stronger pressure is to push things in, you're right. Yeah. And then there's a third perspective is let's try and keep ODA as it is and prevent anything else getting pushed in by creating this broader envelope, this notion of TOSSD. So there's all sorts of motivations behind it, which I guess don't matter at the moment, but I'm interested in your view whether these sort of conceptual and, I guess questions around the rules of ODA reporting can have a positive or negative impact on the actual supply of resources for global public goods.
No, I think it's putting up big numbers without asking what the numbers mean and can achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I said, remittances, I think we shouldn't bother about at all. Whatever they do with it is fine. Private finance goes where one hopes where there is a return to be made.
Yeah.
And there may be limited things. And so I find it confused and confusing to have this system.
But in principle, might it be a little bit along the lines of what you were describing at the beginning, which is, you've got ODA and then you've got a broader category of international public finance. All of that is TOSSD. And then in addition, they track but do not claim as official the private and the remittances. So, could you think of that as your financing envelope for global public goods, or at least the beginnings of one?
No, I want order is one strand. TPG is another strand. And some money, a developing country decides to let some money from order come back to GPG, but that is then counted here as the country's contribution.
Yeah. Yeah.
The developing country's contribution to GPG. And therefore, one shouldn't muddle it up. And that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And we proposed to have a World Bank outfit to count GPG financing as a companion for DAC. DAC for ODA, and then the work. Who proposed it the other day? Somewhere. And I think that's absolutely necessary to have somebody who where countries report their GPG financing to. And
it is actually a striking lack after all this time.
Yeah. What is it? Jeffrey Sachs, in his latest report on decarbonization. It has to be clear. And this official support comes private finance mobilized by order.
But they don't know how yet.
Yeah, that's right.
To finish off, I wanted to focus more directly on the question of multilateral architecture.
The general architectural question, and then the question about how some of the more significant multilateral organizations like the World Bank actually operate. How could these things be better structured to deliver global public goods? You've talked in detail already about the idea of issue czars, let's say.
I always compare public goods and related activities to private goods. And I have never seen a conveyor belt where they have one car followed by a refrigerator on one and the same conveyor belt. It simply does not happen. So given the complexity of some of the problems, I really think that and I'm always fighting with my countryman Helmut Weisen, who laments about fragmentation. I said, well, it's not fragmented. There may be some fragmentation because donors all want to play around. But basically, when you keep in mind externalities, most of these single issue mechanisms make a lot of sense. They are fighting an externality. They are very targeted. And even the people you have to bring together around a malaria vaccine are different from TB or HIV/AIDS. So it's even daring to lump them, these three diseases, into one fund. So you have to deal with each externality separately. And in the climate field, where you can do carbon capture, and you can do clean energy, and you can deal with the oceans, and so you need many, many sub-managers there too. And I would rather see some arrangement like this. It's very issue-focused product, get it done, than these lumpy organizations of the past. You need them. The IMF we need, I can, because it's, even if you have regional ones, there may still be some helping hand needed one day, or look at the global balances altogether. But steward looking. But then we have to decide who is the steward. I think governments have their particular interests, so they will never really take care of the global commons. And we should have in the UN a nudging body, not a legislative, but nudging, where there are people who represent the ocean, and the atmosphere, and the biodiversity, and the fishes, or whatever. And then there can also be a few country representatives. And they could then also say, okay, we need probably to put more money in there rather than there. They could keep the balances in mind. And whether we need the World Bank, for what would we need the World Bank?
Well, one, to be a devil's advocate, so you talked earlier about... there is a place for conditionality when you're dealing with global public goods, because you're in that case you're actually receiving a service.
Yeah, but that would come through the mechanisms.
Well, the thing about lumpy amounts of cash, though, is that they're far more effective in achieving the sorts of outcomes that you might want to condition.
No, as long as they have to, countries depend for loans on them.
Yeah.
But many countries don't do anymore.
Yeah.
So it would be, we have to, we honor contracts in the private good area. Why wouldn't we honor contracts in the public good area?
Mm.
If it's not conditionality, but really contracting.
Mm.
Because with the conditionality in the past, it had costs involved for the countries concerned.
Mm.
So nowadays, if it's more mutual agreed. But facilitating access to capital markets, was still some country needed.
Yeah, and for creating some of those incentives that you talked about, let's say in the case of Brazil, if there's no source of large-scale public financing, let's say the bank was a far more flexible source than it is, and it could just blend terms at will to make a package attractive, to achieve the necessary shift in business as usual. Then you could make a case for having a lumpy mechanism, provided it had the right strategy and the right sort of tools.
But then, first of all, they need to change their voice structure.
Yeah.
They would have to be a totally different bank. Yeah. It could be something like a budget document.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be then an additional layer, so one could send pool financing to the bank.
Yes.
And the bank then would continue to act as a fiduciary agent for the global fund they do, and so for the Green Climate Fund, I think they do.
Yeah.
Some function like this, but it would be quite different from what it is now.
And the other strength, I guess, of the bank is its country presence is in many cases so deep So if it was receiving global public good funds and programming those in partnership with the government and was using them flexibly and as part of a global strategy, that could be a good thing and more effective than having essentially small advocacy.
Yeah, outcomes. Well, then we should close UNDP, which yep. would probably be the easier thing to do. But it would be a radically different outfit. Either we close this one and let it wither away, or they should be prepared to have quite a different governance structure.
Mm. And do you think the emergence of the Asian Infrastructure Bank and the new development, I mean, presumably that almost, apart from increasing the irrelevance of the bank, it creates an opportunity for the bank to fill a different role.
Yeah, but then they have to jump now and say we are, you know, I mean, it would be good to have a consolidated budget and then they would begin to play the role that Jeffrey had in mind for them too. Jeffrey looked at them as a sort of a duck for GPGs. But that is an accountant role. But we want a country presence. That would be good to have multilateral ambassadors. And so we close UNDP and...
Now, by way of closing, I wanted to give you an opportunity to perhaps say a bit more about the Global Stewardship Council idea. And anything you want to say to wrap up everything that we've discussed today?
Basically, these ideas have to be approached as a package. Mm-hmm. If you have the dual strength GPG and ODA, then and you want systematically to deal with global public goods, then you need the issue managers. Mm-hmm. And if you focus on the negotiation side, which exists more than on the operational side, and on the operational side, of course, you have to see that the goods are very complex, and inputs can be coming from our side. Hand washing is good for disease control and whatnot. So it's the private households, the private firms, national governments. So many inputs have to come together. Therefore, you need this CEO type of guy, and then you have to have the sub-managers. And if we look at the current landscape, institutional landscape, from that point of view, you actually can create these lumps. Mm. Yeah, and you see, that all contributes. And the fascinating thing is that you then see that we may be wasting a lot of money because investment in education serves at the same time health and maternal mortality reduction and whatnot, and maybe also good for the climate. So by having a production path in mind, you can also create linkages better. And what you see, if you look good by good, and then remember that they all end up in the global public domain, you also see how some global public goods are colliding with each other, like trips and global health and climate. So it's there are synergies to be promoted, and all of this will result in cost savings. If you keep this in mind, then of course we have to break out of the statist orientation we have in our governance structures and bring the global commons voices in, and the voices of the future generations. Because many of these issues have include stock externalities and have a long duration.
So that was my main question about the Global Stewardship Council, because in a sense you can't avoid statism. I guess the question is how to connect non-state voices with political decision making. So I wanted to ask you about G20. A lot of this is about ensuring that the whole multilateral system functions as one and seeking to produce global public goods. So it really involves working across the existing governance structures of major multilateral organisations, and nobody can really do that, you would think, except the G20. Can't direct, it wasn't built to correct, but it wields such a lot of power.
No, but now the UN, although they again made it, it's just the oil crew, this high level forum. It's just they invent bodies and they're the same people go from one.
Like the global Partnership for Effective Development.
Therefore, I thought if you had these Gareth Evans or Horst Köhler here, yeah, people who don't have any personal goals to achieve. They are themselves, independent, but visionary. And if they were to sit in such a stewardship council with a lot of political clout and tell Steph, listen, I mean, here's a win-win that you could exit.
Would it be connected to any existing political international body? Or
it would be, I suggest it be under UN umbrella, the UN. And we have the old stewardship council, as we have already the room.
Yeah.
We only need the body. Yeah. And so this new global stewardship council could move and meet in this trusteeship council room. And then we would introduce these issue managers. And within countries, I suggest dual track budgeting, which means that our national budgets would indicate, in order to tie our hands a little bit, which money is to be dispersed nationally and which internationally. Because according to the budget rules of most countries, only foreign affairs can disperse money abroad, or AusAid or our BMZ, not the others. But all ministries by now have some external relations and operations abroad. So therefore we put the climate money, in our case, is in the older budget. Mm-hmm. And the climate ministry spends all its money in Germany. And only UNICEF is in foreign affairs, that is a relic of the wartime, the poor children. So, and refugee money, I think, too. So one has to, this restructuring, and it is coming. I'm very optimistic because I always see that reality is ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, and you see in Canada, they do a lot of this is identifying of money, whether it's going for national purposes or internationally. In the Netherlands, they did. I think by now they have stopped doing it. But basically, we need some adjustments. So a few years more, and you would say, I discussed this with them.
So the multilateral system has really not changed except to generate new mechanisms in the last, 40 years. We've seen a rash of new environmental and health financing mechanisms in the last sort of 15 years. But nothing has ever been closed down, whether it be UNDP or anything else. Do you see any sort of drivers for significant change in the multilateral architecture, in part as a result of...
I have seen dramatic change, like from walking on our feet until the late 1980s. What am I talking about? The early 80s. And then when structural adjustment came, how we made a flop. Mm-hmm. Where there is a will and a push, there is a way. Mm-hmm. The conditionality came. Mm-hmm. And tapered off again. It always takes 10, 20 years, but there have been significant changes. When I started in the UN, you couldn't, we were, the department was called Department of International Economic and Social Affairs. After 1990, the international was deleted. Because we started looking into countries, which was a no-no before. So, yes, it's possible, But I mean, at the same time, I can see that Richard Cooper has a point when he says it needs three big crises.
Yeah.
Before, but it's sad if it should be really necessary. Mm. Why not with a little foresight and goodwill? And when Obama can tell to the Cubans that the time of direct interference, or what did he say, are over, that's the beginning.
Mm. I mean, the kind of structure that you portray is so logical and so compelling. What do you see as the barriers? Why is it not the case that all governments require their multilateral institutions to cooperate to develop cross-institutional strategies for delivering major global public goods? Why do they run around separately?
No, the political economy. One thing is, as I said, a lot has to do with how budgets are being designed. Mm-hmm. That you can, as a politician, you want to spend your money in your constituency. Mm-hmm. And you don't get credit for saying I averted a storm, mm. but you get credit for repainting the house after a flooding. Mm. So there is this bias towards local expenditure and not letting money go. And there is, we have at present no theory for this. Mm. We have a market failure theory. But in the presence of global public goods, we have dual actor failure, state and markets. And this raises the question, how do we, under these circumstances, nevertheless get a relatively efficient provision of global public goods? And that needs a lot of incentive thinking. And the biggest, in my view, the biggest obstacle to, and therefore the crises are accumulating, to less crisis-prone growth and development are the state governments. Because I have seen pension funds and other big investment funds and other firms crying out for a standardized environmental regulation. Because they say the search costs for us or the risk that we take too high. Mm. But then governments go back and rather maintain their flexibility by not having a common regulation, whether it's in financial markets or the environment, hoping to have a national advantage from it.
I'm just very interested that even after governments have made financial allocations to the multilateral system, which we're part of what you're talking about, so they've already made the resource appropriation and allocation decisions, but then they have such low expectations of the multilateral system. They don't say, with the money we've given you, we expect you to do so much more than you do. And I'm not sure why that is, but I think it's maybe to do with the way multilaterals are positioned as delivery agents of bilateral aid money.
But it is, I think it's a myth. I must say, compared to what I see here, the UN is great. Mm. I was influenced by this talk about multilateralism when I was in the UN, but my God, I mean, we are hardworking, we are efficient, we are quick, but here...
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true within organisations. I guess what I don't see is genuine cross-institutional strategies.
No, because we have this is the organisational transformation that is still there, and it's political economy. Then you have department heads who don't want to move and people who don't want to transfer. In the UN, we went through a lot of organizational change management, and it was brutal in part. Mm-hmm. Mark Miller Brown had a strong hand in this, but I can't see that. Here it's still very silo type. They would have to, I mean, we need someone who is in climate, environment is too broad. And then you have a Ministry of the Economy, but how does it relate to environment? So we should have someone who deals with energy specifically. And nobody deals really with global health. It's a meager unit within the health ministry. And certainly not identified in the budget. So there is, it has to...
That's interesting. So you see it as much to do with how...
Institutional locking.
The system of the actual system.
And that's about where we left our conversation. As I said at the beginning of the first episode, my visit to Berlin to speak with Inge was supported by the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies. The article that I produced for their online journal, International Development Policy, can be found on its website. Thanks for listening.